The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Qingyuan and the Price of Rice, the pointer. Siddhartha cut off his flesh to give to his parents, yet is not listed in the legends of filial children. Devadatta pushed over a mountain to crush the Buddha, but did he fear the sound of sudden thunder? Having passed through the forest of thorns and cut down the sandalwood tree, just wait till the year ends. As of old, early spring is still cold. Where is the Buddha's body of reality? A student was asked Master Qingyuan, what is the great meaning of Buddhism? Qingyuan said, what is the price of rice in Luling? Hongzhi's poem. The accomplishing work of great peace has no sign. The family way of the peasants is most pristine. Only concerned with village songs and festival drinking, how would they know of the virtues of Shun or the benevolence of Yao? So here we are in the last day of our full day of our session. And I'm still trying to find my way through the vagaries of I don't think it's just jet lag. I think it's winter to summer, dark to light, driving on the wrong side of the road. All of it. And that we're not actually meant to get into a metal tube and fly across the world. But we do. There's this greetings from the New Zealand Sangha. I, as I always do, extended an invitation to the students there to come and visit us, to train. And so maybe we'll see a few. And there's always an open invitation for Sangha members from here to go and do session when Hojin Sensei goes in January or I go in July. If you can handle the trip, they'll put you up. So, Qingyuan was a disciple of Huainong. So this is very early in the Zen tradition. And Qingyuan was succeeded by Shi Tao, who authored The Identity of Relative and Absolute. And it said that he had a dream one night where he was riding a tortoise with his teacher across the vast expanse of the sea. And when he woke up, he saw the tortoise as wisdom, the sea as conditioned existence, and that that inspired him to write The Identity of Relative and Absolute. And Shi Tao, when he was, actually it was Huainong, when he was getting ready to transmit the Dharma to Qingyuan, he said up to that point, the beginning with Bodhidharma, Bodhidharma had transmitted the Dharma along with his robe, his okesa, as a symbol of having received that empowerment. And Huainong said, in the past, the robe and teaching had been passed down together, each generation of teacher and student passing them on in turn. The robe has been the evidence of the transmission. The authentic teaching is passed from mind to mind. Now I have suitable heirs. Why worry about not having evidence of transmission, that is, an object? Since I received the robe, I've encountered innumerable difficulties. Moreover, in future times, the competition for preeminence between the Zen schools will be even greater. The robe will remain at Zhen Mountain Gate, where Huainong was teaching. You must establish a separate assembly and expound the teaching. Don't allow the Dharma to be cut off. So it's kind of interesting that that was the point at which that tradition was discontinued because of the trouble it caused. This simple robe, minding its own business, not causing any trouble. But that's what we do. We get caught up in things. Even practitioners, sanghas, and so on. And so that's why in transmission to this day, the robe is transmitted, transmission robe, but it's not Bodhidharma's, which would be in some particular state at this point. It would just be transmitting threads. So in the pointer, this is a nice example of the use of poetry in a way to convey something of the Dharma. So the Buddha cut off his flesh. So it said that the Buddha cut off his flesh and gave it to his parents as an expression of his deep gratitude. And yet he is not listed in the legends of filial children. Devadatta, on the other hand, a cousin of the Buddha who tried to kill the Buddha several times and wanted to push the Buddha out and take his place, pushed over a mountain to crush the Buddha, but did not fear the sound of sudden thunder. And so the Buddha gave his whole life, yet was not listed as a faithful child. Devadatta committed this unimaginable harm, and yet was unafraid of thunder, it says in the poem. And so the student has to engage this, and like, what is being said? And another barrier is time and distance and language and culture. Often these references would be to something that would have been understood easily at that time. But if we think of being free of the worldly concerns of fame and ridicule, gain and loss, happiness and sadness, praise and blame, Siddhartha was free, even Devadatta was free, the poem is pointing to. And then, where is the Buddha's body of reality? What is the true body? So the Dharmakaya, the three bodies of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya is the body of reality. The body, there are ways of, one way of looking at this is there are ways of sort of thinking about or imagining the Buddha to begin with as our first teacher. How can we think about this person, this human being, this being that gained this profound enlightenment, the thought that changed the world, liberated so many and still is. And so we can't think of him as just an ordinary being in an ordinary sense. It's too small. And so there's a Dharma body, a body of reality that everyone possesses, a body that is free of time and place, history, memories. The body that we struggle with on this cushion is not the Dharma body. It's the historical body. It's the body of our memories and our histories and actions and consequences. All of that stuff. You know, if we just put a sign on the front door and said, you are welcome to enter, but you cannot bring any story with you, this would be a very different thing going on here. Of course, no one would be here. So the Dharma body, without any characteristics or signs or attributes, unborn, unconditioned. So he asks, where is this body of reality? How is it to be realized? How does it appear? Emptiness is form. We can't see, touch, taste emptiness. It can only be known in form, as it appears in things. But that's fine because they have the same nature. They're the same reality. So what is this body of reality? And so a student asked Qinghuang, what is the great meaning of Buddhism? And the footnote says, a minor official often thinks about the rules. You know, it's like when we're beginning anything, we're coming to training, and we spend a lot of time just thinking about the rules, the schedule. Where am I supposed to be? Showing up on time. How do I do zazen? What are all these instruments? When do I bow? We think about the rules, right? What is the great meaning of Buddhism? It's an honest question. But the footnote is pointing to that ultimately we are not going to find what we seek in explanations and philosophies. Now, everyone's heard that before. Everybody who comes into Buddhist practice hears that early on and again and again and again. And so it's like, yeah, I get that. Why do you keep saying that? Because we keep turning towards and looking for what we seek in explanations and ideas. We come into practice having trusted those our whole life, relied upon them, used them, developed them, protected them, fought for them. We're not just going to give those up. But they cannot bring us home. They can turn us in the right direction. They can help us understand the path that we're on. They can give us a sense of what is practice. But only to a point. And the moment we sit down to begin doing zazen, we realize the limitation of those instructions. They guide, but they don't actually tell you what to do in this particular moment. I mean, that's not entirely true, but true enough. So what is the living now of Buddha Dharma? Because that's the whole deal. That's the thing. It's not about just having a philosophical understanding. It's not about just being able to talk about great ideas, Buddhist ideas. It's about the living truth of it. As in living in us, in this life, in this body and mind. And Qinghuang says, what is the price of rice in Luling? And the footnote says, an old general doesn't talk about soldiering. Ryokan, the old Zen monk and poet, said, when you no longer call my poems poems, then we can talk about poetry. When you no longer call me a poet, then maybe we can have something meaningful to say about poetry. David Hinton's translation of the Tao Te Ching begins, name can name no lasting name. Nameless is the origin of heaven and earth. Naming is the mother of 10,000 things. This is the gateway to all mystery. So we come in embedded, immersed, saturated, marinated in naming, recognizing, identifying, the mother of 10,000 things. And we bring them all with us. Nameless is the source, going back to the origin of heaven and earth, of all things. So what is the great meaning of Buddhism? What is the price of rice in Luling? So every day there's buying and selling. Somebody asks a question, there's an answer. Something is given, something is received. Is this all there is to it? Is this what it comes down to? I don't think anybody would at least be willing to say out loud that they want to practice and realize themselves and have it nothing to do with, and have it to have nothing to do with their life. To be completely separated, divorced. Of course we want it to unify. We want our lives to be liberated. And so there's a sense of unifying the self with the entire universe, harmonizing, as Dogen said, inner and outer. Aspiration and action, experience with embodiment. And yet, Qingyuan saying, what is the price of rice in Wuling? Is that just a little bit too ordinary? A little bit too plain? Don't we want something a little more, you know, jazzy? Holy? Among human beings, there are wise ones and fools, but in the way, there's no northern or southern ancestor. No school, one higher than the other. No sudden or gradual enlightenment. No enlightenment, no delusion. Zhao Zhou, when he first met Nanquan, his teacher, said, what is the way? And Nanquan said, ordinary mind is the way. And Zhao Zhou said, well, should I direct myself towards it? How do I approach it? How do I get to it? And Nanquan said, if you move towards it, then you're moving away from it. Then Zhao Zhou very reasonably said, well, then how will I know? How will I know that I have realized, attained, reached this ordinary way? And Nanquan said, it's beyond knowing or not knowing. The accomplishing work of great peace has no sign. That's why practice is challenging. If it was just about knowing and naming and identifying, we'd all be there. Everybody would be there. The fact that we come so sort of tethered to that use of mind and to our attachments to it. So how do we cultivate a deep trust in the rest of our mind, in the, let's say, the other aspect of our consciousness? And so we sit, we have to find a direct way in. And when that naming, the mother of 10,000 things, comes up with another name, another sign, another characteristic, another memory, what do we do? That's our mind. That's an incredibly powerful capacity that we have. We're not trying to extinguish it. But if we think of, you know, all of samsara as a kind of misuse, a not well used application of this wondrous mind, how do we use it? How do we move in accord? How do we harmonize? How do we free it up? And so there's a sense that, well, we have to go beyond that mind. We have to somehow get beyond this, right? Isn't that what letting go of thoughts is? Going beyond. In a way, that language exists. Going beyond. But Dogen makes it clear when he says, going beyond, going beyond. What is ordinary mind? In Moonbeam's teaching of the Kagyu lineage, it's interesting that there's a whole section on ordinary mind. It talks about the Tibetan term for ordinary mind, which means both a very natural state. And natural here doesn't mean habitual. You know, if you smoke a couple packs of cigarette for 10 years, smoking will seem a most natural thing, right? It doesn't mean that. It means natural in the sense of uncontrived, before any effort, not the result of any action. But it also has the sense of common, ordinary, common, every day. It says ordinary mind thus refers to the natural condition of mind, your natural state of mind, which is luminous and untarnished by defilements. Defilements appear, but it's untarnished. It's not defiled by defilements, which arise from emotional conflicts and so on. It says the masters of the Kagyu lineage are not the only ones to call this incorruptible nature ordinary mind. And so it's a very strong teaching within the Zen tradition. One old master said, ordinary mind is pure when left in its natural condition. Don't corrupt it through interference. Don't try to grasp onto it. Don't try to release it. Simply leave it in its natural state. But that doesn't mean just sitting and being passive, because that's not our natural state. When we sit passively, what happens is the conditioned, habitual, karmic mind runs free, right? It just keeps doing what it's doing. That's not the natural state. And so, curiously, strangely, if we can, humorously, we have to apply great effort to do something that seems unnatural, to return to this most natural state of mind. Just like if that two-pack-a-day smoker tries to stop smoking, that's just not going to feel right. There's going to be a fight, a struggle. They're going to have to really apply their effort to doing that. I don't know that from personal experience, but I've watched it happen. There was a time years ago when Dada Roshi, who smoked a lot, and the head monk, and there were a couple of other seniors, they created a pact that they were all going to stop smoking together. And it's like, nobody wanted to go into Doksan. I'm not going, you go. No, you know, the call would be made and everybody would take a long time getting, you know. Because he was a terror, right? Not in a good mood. We were praying that he would start smoking. And we can be kind of like that too, right? When we try and give something cherished up. Another teacher says, Milarepa says, meditators who try to grasp ordinary mind are deluded. Should I direct myself towards it? Nanquan says, if you do, you're going to move away from it. Milarepa says, ordinary mind will elude such an effort. To cultivate ordinary mind is supreme among all practices. It's the Buddha embodied in a human form. Anyone who wishes to cut through the root of cyclic existence needs to cultivate a proper understanding of ordinary mind. And it sounds so simple because it's ordinary, because it's our natural state. Well, yeah, so like, what's the problem? And yet these teachings say that one master said, if you approach ordinary mind only from the aspect of non-conceptuality, so that ordinarily we think, well, it just means, you know, be free of thoughts. Don't give rise to any ideas. But it says that then we'll be ignoring the aspects of conceptuality and things that appear, which is just another exercise in accepting and rejecting. Trying to obtain ordinary mind by trying to reject ideas, concepts. It must be said, however, this teacher says, that a full understanding of ordinary mind is extremely difficult to attain. So again, it's curious, it's something that sounds so simple, it's ordinary, would be so difficult. So think about training. We sit on this cushion and practice this ordinary mind to not interfere with the mind. It's the basis of mindfulness, is that when something arises, you don't interfere, right? Which is so hard, right? Because when if we don't like what we see, we want to interfere with it. We want to change it, get it out. Make it better, improve it. Students working on a koan, when a koan is difficult, or sometimes just from the very beginning, student will encounter a koan and say, oh, this is just not enough. There's not enough information here. So they'll fill in the spaces, fill in the gaps, improve it, right? It's like telling a story. Something happens, you tell a story, and you make it a little bit better. You tell it again, you make it a little bit better, even more. It's a better story. It's hard not to interfere. And so we practice non-interference, not grasping, not releasing, but what is letting go of a thought? It's letting go of that which is the conditioned mind in order to experience that natural state. But really, Shoen said yesterday, releasing it, letting go, you know, that language is good because we have let go of things, right? You drop something out of your hand, everybody's let go of thoughts, right? And so it sort of makes sense to us. Things are objects, we let go of them. Thoughts are objects, we let go of them. But really what we're doing is practicing our attention. We're redirecting our attention. The breath, thought comes up, our attention goes over here to the thought and runs. We notice, and then we redirect our attention. That's actually what's happening. In order to do that, we have to not grasp, right? Because if we bring this back with us, we won't have redirected our attention. And then we get off the cushion and we walk and we do bows and we chant. We have a meal, we serve, we do some work. We do very ordinary things, very common things that we do every day. And the practice is to actually do those ordinary things with ordinary mind. So in this text, it's broken down a little bit. It said ordinary mind has to be understood in relationship to three aspects of your basic mind, your nature of mind. First, the nature of mind itself. So in order to really understand, appreciate, apprehend, realize ordinary mind, we have to realize the nature of mind, the basis of the mind. That's why there's so much emphasis on calming the mind, right? Because all of those, the activity of the mind, those strong emotions and so on, the teacher refers to. Everything that binds us and obstructs and hinders and causes pain and suffering and confusion, it overwhelms us, right? We get caught into it. We're seduced by it. And so we have to practice freeing ourselves and disentangling, right? Not disattaching, not attaching, in order to realize the nature of mind. Unborn, when we're no longer creating, Vimalakirti says, we're no longer actively involved in the process of unreal mental constructions, we can then realize the nature of mind, the true body, free, boundless, vast, expansive. But we also have to understand deeply, experientially, conceptuality, the mind that thinks, the mind that has ideas. Right? Because otherwise, how can we harmonize with our lives if we don't understand the nature of this very important aspect of our consciousness and where we spend a lot of our time? Thinking, planning, making decisions, solving problems, doing work, reading poetry, writing poetry. If that has to be kept outside the door, then we can't unify. We can't integrate. We can't live the Dharma. And so what we're calling conceptuality has to be very deeply understood directly, experientially. And then the third aspect is the appearance of phenomena. We have to bring that all together in the world of things. And so in the Chan tradition, Zen tradition, all of that is happening from the very beginning, all together. So we're practicing, that's the Bodhidharma's direct pointing to the human mind. Sitting directly and going directly into the nature of mind. And in each moment when something arises, naming, the mother of 10,000 things, we see it and let go. And when we say acknowledge, that's a little pale, right? It's not enough. It's not just, yeah, I see something way over there. It's like actually seeing and gaining understanding, beginning to gain understanding, which is dependent upon the quality of our attention and awareness. We're not just letting go of thoughts to have a calm mind, we're letting go of thoughts as we're gaining insight into the nature of thoughts, conceptually, that part of our mind. And not just that we think that this thought I like, this thought I don't like, but actually what is the nature of this thought? This koan points directly to that. What is the price of rice in Luling? A question about rice. How much does it cost in Luling? That's a concept, right? Using words and meaning and language. Something that appears in the phenomenal world. When the basis of that is just samsara, then it's just a question about the price of rice. When the source of that is the nature of mind, then what is it? This ordinary mind is the practice realization of a lifetime. I remember when I worked on that koan of Zhao Zhou and Nanquan, I worked on it for a while. My teacher said, go on to the next koan. And I did, and I knew that there was much I had not yet understood about that. I remember thinking, this koan, I will might spend the rest of my life understanding. So far, that's still true. And so, in sanghas, in a world where we practice and study Dharma, talk about Dharma, let's be careful about that. Let's be careful, which is another way of saying, let's be respectful of the Dharma, which is really another way of saying, let's be respectful of ourselves. And be alert and awake and perhaps a little cautious about how we speak about such things. Because when we speak about things that are so important and deep and profound, and we speak about them very casually, right, and just throw it around, that's not really helping us, because we're conditioning our mind. When we speak, we're creating karma. When we speak, we hear our own words, right? It comes from within us, and it comes back, and it affirms something, it strengthens something. So I'm not saying don't have Dharma conversations, but we should be aware. You know, that's why with new residents, sometimes we'll say, you know, when people come in, for an introductory retreat, for instance, and you're having a meal, and they start asking you Dharma questions, tell me about the Four Noble Truths, right? How to respond from what you actually know, which gives you complete permission to say, I don't know. I don't know yet. I'm studying this. I want to understand this. My understanding is limited. This is what I've read. This is a book you might go to if you're interested. And it helps to keep our feet on the ground. And not just so we don't mess up somebody else's understanding or we don't give rise to a kind of pride or arrogance, but also so we don't mess with our mind. And in a way, start to diminish, cheapen something that's actually really important and should be held. Not like, you know, with white gloves that never get dirty, but held with respect. Ordinary mind is like that, I think. I think of Dogen in regard to the precepts where he says, don't comment on them, just practice them. Right? Let's not comment too much on ordinary mind. Let's just practice it. What is it? What is the living truth of Buddha Dharma? And Qingyuan says, what is the price of rice in Luling? All things have the same essence. All things in their essence are without conflict. This ordinary mind is the essential and complete embodiment of that. It is Prajnaparamita. It is what we're actually seeking before we even know it. And yet it sounds so simple. And in a way, it is, and that's what makes it so hard. Because we've made our minds very complicated and layered. And so it takes a lot of effort to return to that, not that natural state, and then to integrate, to unify, to embody that in the common state. I was reading an article by Wendell Berry from a book that I have called The Way of Ignorance. And I've drawn from this before, but he says, he's talking about ignorance. And he says, in general, we should worry about the origins of the permission we've given ourselves to do large-scale damage. That permission is our problem, for by it we have made our ignorance arrogant and given it immeasurable power to do harm. We're killing the world on the theory that it was never alive, but is only an accidental concatenation of materials and mechanical processes. It's like a machine. Somebody said that once and had a big influence. We're killing one another and ourselves on the same theory. If life has no standing as mystery or miracle or gift, then what signifies the difference between it and death? If life has no mystery or miracle or gift, are we alive? I think he's saying. And then he quotes a passage from Ezra Pound, who studied a lot about Chinese culture and literature and Confucius. And in this section, Ezra Pound translates loosely, I think. When people of old wanted to clarify and diffuse throughout the empire that light which comes from looking straight into the heart and then acting, first they set up good government in their own states. And then, wanting good government in their states, they then established order within their families. And then, wanting order in their home, they then disciplined themselves, desiring self-discipline. They rectified their own hearts. And then, wanting to rectify their hearts, they sought precise verbal definitions of their inarticulate thoughts. And then, wishing to attain precise verbal definitions, they set to extend their knowledge to the utmost. And if we think of knowledge here as wisdom, to extend our wisdom to the utmost, so that we may speak and think in a way that is, he translated it as precise, right? If we think of it as authentic, in accord with what is true and real. And then if we want to do that, we have to clarify our own hearts. And if we want to do that, we have to clean up our house. And if we want to do that, then we have to clean up the whole house, the big house. There is no downstream to the river. There is no over there in the field. From the first moment we began sitting Zazen, we came to this seat and we sat down in the midst of the whole thing. The whole thing. Nobody ever freed themselves gained understanding or insight, let go of something before or after this moment. They never did it over there. They never did it yesterday or tomorrow. They never did it to someone else. They never did it in a different state of mind, a better one. This is what we call mountain training. The accomplishing work of great peace has no sign, no characteristics, no attributes. It has no utterly existent sign. Nothing fixed, nothing permanent. So how is it that things can have so much power? A thought, just words in the mind. And it seems like they have their own power. It seems like the emotion has its own power. It seems like something that happens out there and we react happens out there. When we receive beginning instructions, Zazen, in a certain sense, that's all we need to know. You've been given the full Monty, the whole thing, the whole menu. But it just takes a while to actually sit down to the table, take a look, begin to taste, chew, digest, assimilate. Dogen said, Zazen is not meditation practice. It is simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease. You know, when you were talking yesterday about Myo Thai saying, just try and enjoy working on Mu, you said you were confounded, I would have been pissed off. I'm like, yeah, it's easy for you to say that, right? I'll enjoy it once it's all done. Tell that, it's a misery. It's simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease. I got pissed off at Dogen too when I read this years ago. That just seemed like, what world are you living in? That's not my world. I don't even know how to think about that. And it's hard. It's hard to consider such a thing when we are in pain. I mean, you have a cold. It's just a cold. And it just affects the whole body. Right? It's hard to have spirit. It's hard to be generous. It just makes things hard. And part of that is because we identify with it, but we also feel it so keenly. And I think that's why these teachings are so important. It's the Dharma gate of joyful ease. I don't know what you're talking about, but I would like to. I really would like to know that. The practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. The family way of the peasants is most pristine. Only concerned with village songs and festival drinking, how would they know of the virtues of Shun, or the benevolence of Yao, two ancients who are held in high regard for their accomplishments? What's being held up is the family way of the peasant, the ordinary being. Look at the 10th Oxford picture downstairs. Just an old, bedraggled person, dirty, tattered. Pass them in the market, you might not even notice them. That's what's held up in high regard, right? Losing all of the shine. The seeking mind. We are on a seeking path. And how to seek is what's important. When I was on the plane coming back from New Zealand, I sat down, you know, you sit down next to this person, a stranger, to spend the next 15 hours. Right? Cheek to cheek. So we sat down, did our, you know, hi, how you doing? She pulled a blanket over her head, and that was it. for a long, impressively long time. And then towards the end, she got up, was woke up and she had Bluetooth things in her ears. And she started looking. We were just a couple hours out from New York, and she started looking for something, looking. She was taking all, I said, what's going on? She said, I lost my one of my things. And she's taking everything apart, and she's getting up and standing on her seat and pulling it up and looking underneath. I mean, she's really looking for this thing. And she kept, and then she sat down for a while. And then she got up and she started again, looking and looking. And I'm just like, she really wants to find this thing. And then she looked at me and she said, I found it. I said, oh. She goes, but I can't reach it. My arm's not long enough. She said, I think your arm is longer. I said, okay. So, you know, I'm climbing over her. She's climbing under me. We were right in the very back next to the wall, and she was next to the window in the corner. And I can't see it. So she gives me her flashlight phone, and I'm looking. And I said, yeah, I can see it. And so I'm reaching. I can't see it, but I'm reaching. I said, I can't reach it. My arm's not long enough. And so I pulled out a card, and I said, let me see it. So I'm trying to, you know, tap it. But there's other flotsam and jetsam down there, so I'm like trying to rake it all in. So I'd rake it, and I said, I need to look, so scalpel, please. So she'd hand me the flashlight, and I'd look, and I'd say, okay, menu. So I, you know, back and forth. And finally I said, I think I got it. So we change places, and she climbs underneath. She says, I got it. And I looked at her and I said, you so deserve that. You have great determination. And we sat down, and she looked at me and she said, what do you do for a living? And then from the, I'm glad this happened before we landed, because I'm afraid it would have been 15 hours of questions about meditation. And so, all of that just to come back here, this place we've never left. But just remember, everyone before you has sat on the same seat, in the same mind, face their own version of exactly the same thing. Their own version of exactly the same thing. Troubled by their time and place, their own version of, you know, samsara. That's what we have inherited. That's what we pass down. The entanglements as well as the liberation. And that's why it matters. That's why it matters. That people all over the world, in their different ways, trying to make sense of things in a real way, so that they can live within that in a real way and offer something good in a real way.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.